Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, April 1st, 2006. Our focus today is on women and the environment, as we leave Women's History Month behind and enter the month of Earth Day. Here's what we have coming up. Our news today will consist of a report from political prisoner Lori Berenson about the upcoming elections in Peru, followed by EcoShock Radio on the Revolutionary Report from ABC News addressing climate change. Then we'll hear an interview of Cayetana Carrion from the Women's Environmental Development Organization about the ways women are disproportionately affected by climate change. Our next interview we air will be of Linda Bazal-Salzman, an eco-psychologist, psychotherapist, and permaculturist, talking about ways of healing the human-nature split. We'll also hear from Michael Parenti about crime in the suites, music, announcements, and more. So stay with us. First, for Lori Berenson's report on the upcoming elections in Peru.
My name is Lori Berenson. I'm a U.S. citizen and a political prisoner. I am serving my 11th year of a 20-year sentence in Peru. This essay was written from my cell in Huacarí's prison. Peruvian elections. Finally, the Peruvian elections are coming up. On April 9, Peruvians will vote for their president and congressional representatives. As odd as it may sound, Peru has been living in a quasi-electoral period since about 2002. Most of the actors in the current campaign have been campaigning for years now, although none of the viable candidates have platforms that would create meaningful socioeconomic change. In Latin America, over the last few years, moderate, progressive, and nationalist candidates have come to power through elections. This seems to indicate that voters mark their ballots against the social and economic neoliberal models. However, once in power, how much can a government do when any just measures would be contrary to the mandates of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the White House? In Peru, a country with less than 30 million in population, there are 24 presidential candidates. Among the few that have any chance of winning, the majority represent the right wing. But more than any particular candidate, what is really winning in the polls is indecision and a lack of faith in the political electoral system in general. One wonders if any of these 24 candidates could make Peru a more livable place for its citizens. I certainly doubt it. Only time will tell the outcome. From Huacarí's prison in northern Peru, this is Lori Berenson. This commentary was produced by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio and read by Aura Bogado.
And now for EcoShock News about climate change.
I never thought I'd live to hear the day. ABC News finally admits there is global warming, and we're doing it. And the American people, 85% of them, know about it. ABC News is doing a primetime special across all of their programming from Good Morning to This Week to ABC World News Tonight all this week.
This week, ABC News is taking an in-depth look at the problem of global warming. And tonight, we introduce a major new poll conducted by ABC, Time Magazine, and Stanford University. A vast majority of Americans, 85%, now believe global warming is probably happening and that it will become a serious problem in the future. ABC's Bill Blakemore, who has covered this subject extensively, joins us tonight with details. Bill?
Well, Kate, there's now consensus among virtually all scientists that global warming is happening, is underway. And almost all scientists agree man-made greenhouse gas emissions are a significant cause. Now scientists tell us the only questions are how we're going to deal with it and try to prevent it getting far worse.
Suddenly, they've discovered there is climate change. It may darn well flood Miami. They show pictures of it. What would happen if only a foot and a half higher seas washed in during certain seasons? How they'd have little raised sidewalks like Venice, perhaps, and how the freshwater drinking system would be overflowed with salt water, and maybe they can build a salt salinization plant in time. We're not even talking about New York City. Here's what housewives and upwardly mobile yuppies got for their Good Morning America on March 26, 2006. Goodbye, Miami.
Bill, imagine waking up to find cities like New York, Miami, Charleston, South Carolina completely submerged underwater. It sounds like something out of a Hollywood movie, but scientists say it could happen because of global warming. Over the next 2 days, ABC News is launching a comprehensive look at the facts and the fears of global warming. This division-wide series looks at the science and possible solutions, and we begin this morning with the threat of massive flooding. ABC's Nancy Wiener joins us now from alongside the Hudson River in New Jersey. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning, Kate. It could mean big changes for iconic skylines like this one. Scientists were recently surprised to find that glaciers in Antarctica and Greenland were melting at speeds up to twice as fast as just a few years ago. And those glaciers are huge. One chunk that just broke off was 100 square miles. And all that water has to go somewhere.
The water wouldn't come crashing down city streets the way it does in the movie The Day After Tomorrow. Instead, according to the new issue of the journal Science, the oceans, fed by rapidly melting glaciers, would rise steadily over years, a total of 13 to 20 feet by the end of this century, threatening huge chunks of American coastal cities, New Orleans, Miami, Charleston, New York.
Do you think New Yorkers will still be able to walk along this promenade in 100 years?
Well, we may have water lapping at our toes.
Vivian Gornitz is a sea level specialist for NASA. She says in the future, storms could regularly swamp this city's subways and tunnels if barriers aren't built to hold back the rising tides. As for that pricey riverfront property,
if these scenarios bear out, they might be underwater more periodically. I mean, the sort of thing that happens in Venice. Each winter they have high floods or high tides where they have to put boardwalks, wooden planks several feet high, for people to walk on to stay out of the water.
Look what could happen to low-lying Miami if the sea level were to rise by just 1.5 feet.
So we know we've got to take some action.
Harvey Reuven leads a team in Miami trying to figure out how to keep the sea from spilling into the city's drinking water reserves in the future.
Certainly building a dike along the 500-mile coastline of Florida probably wouldn't help anyway. It wouldn't be very cost-effective. But looking at things like building a desalinization plant, moving the well fields perhaps further west.
Any of the solutions could run into the millions or billions of dollars. But scientists say the cost of inaction is much higher.
There is no point waiting till we've reached that tipping point. It's then too late. It really is.
They know about the severe storms. They know about the thunderstorms that are coming, about the hurricanes and about the tornadoes and about the flooding. And they know about the drought in other places. But how did this conversion come about? Well, here's the second revelation from ABC. Apparently, folks, the American people have been lied to, and some of the people behind it were the oil industry and even reaching into the White House itself.
The vast majority of scientists have determined global warming to be a real threat. So why has it taken so long to convince Americans? Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ross Gelbspan blames a 15-year misinformation campaign by the oil and coal industries.
The point of this campaign was not necessarily to persuade the public that global warming isn't happening. It was to persuade the public that there is this state of confusion.
This 1998 memo by the American Petroleum Institute says victory will be achieved when average citizens recognize uncertainties in climate science.
Aha. Uh-huh.
To redefine global warming as theory, not fact, the industry funded research by friendly scientists such as Pat Michaels.
The industry's influence even extends into the White House, where up until a few months ago, a former oil industry lobbyist was one of the president's top environmental advisors, editing scientific reports to make global warming seem less threatening.
The oil industry, and even reaching into the White House itself. Is this the Red Revolution? We've heard of the Orange Revolution. The red is the red for heat, for global climate change. We've got news media at the top. Being the revolutionaries, the times are changing.
That was EcoShock Radio, with information about ABC News and their revolutionary reporting on climate change. Now we hear a Healing the Earth interview of Cayetana Carrion from the Women's Environmental Development Organization. She speaks about climate change and women.
Welcome to Healing the Earth Radio, and I'm on the air here with Cayetana from WeDo. Cayetana, how are you doing?
I'm good. Yeah? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming on the air.
Thank you for inviting me.
I wonder if to begin, do you want to introduce what WeDo exactly does?
WeDo, the Women's Environment and Development Organization, was funded in 1992 by Congresswoman Bella Abzug. And it is a global advocacy organization that seeks to promote social and economic justice, human rights for all, and a healthy environment. We believe that gender equality is essential to achieve this. It's important, therefore, to ensure political empowerment of women so that they are able to participate at all decision-making levels equally with men. So our work is really focusing on that, on the need to have women empowered and sharing decision-making positions equally with men. And so we have different programs at WeDo. We work on gender and governance program that works to achieve gender balance in the participation of women and men in all areas and all levels of public life. We also have the economic and social justice program, which focuses on the consequences that our economic system has on women and how to change these. We have a new program, but this is a program that we're developing much more, which is the U.S. policy program, focusing mainly on the implementation of the CEDA treaty, which is the treaty dealing with women's rights in several U.S. states. And finally, we have the Sustainable Development Program, which is the program I'm dealing with, and we work mainly on environmental issues, although we also tackle economic and social issues as well, and always with this focus on gender and women particularly.
Great. It's excellent work. Maybe to begin our interview, can you talk about the crossovers between gender and climate change? Mm-hmm. Like, how does one's gender relate to the ways in which they're disproportionately affected by all the dynamics of climate change?
What we understand by climate change is basically the effects it has on, you know, on the world. And one of the, well, the most well-known, of course, is the natural disasters. And I think we had very sad examples, unfortunately, particularly in 2005 with the tsunami and also with other natural disasters that happened in Central America, but also, as you know, in the U.S. So we understand that natural disasters affect people because of floods, because houses are destroyed, and so they can kill people. And, of course, the victims are men, women, and children. But we have also to take into account that the magnitude of a disaster is also influenced by the political, economic, and social cultural context. And in this regard, it's important, especially if we think about developing countries where most of the disasters have taken place, we have to take into account that there is a high rate of poverty in these countries and that 70% of the poor in the world are women. In addition to that, we have to say that vulnerability is accentuated by race, ethnicity, and age. So when we think about natural disasters, we have to take the gender aspect as well, because we will see that women and men are affected both by natural disasters, but differently because of traditional, socially based roles and responsibilities. Mm. So what happens, actually? In the research that we have been doing here at WeDo together with other organizations, we have identified three gender-specific characteristics to climate change. One of them is that women are affected differently, but also more severely by climate change and natural disasters because of these social roles, discrimination, and poverty. The second one is that women are still underrepresented in decision-making about climate change, which makes it very difficult to have decisions at that level that affect women in an appropriate way. And there are also gender biases in carbon emissions. And so it's very important to tackle the issue in this way, because we understand that, I mean, women and men are different. And in this respect, women have something also to bring in policies regarding climate change and natural disasters. They have an expertise to contribute, and also for the sake of democracy and human rights, it's important to include them as part of the, you know, the human community. So What are how women are affected differently and more severely regarding natural disasters and climate change? So specifically in developing countries, for instance, women are more affected, and as I mentioned, one of the causes is the social and economic situations of these countries or these communities. And so what happens is that very often, for instance, women have these traditional roles at, you know, as homekeepers, as taking care of the children and so on. And even in some countries, they are the ones who are responsible, for instance, to fetch water, to collect fuel and fodder, and so on. And so when natural disaster happens, very often it's very hard to find water in the place where we used to find it, or collect fodder in the areas where we used to find it. But women have to walk even more distances in order to get that. And this affects the time that they could have to dedicate to other activities, like, for instance, education, working, and so on. And at the same time, it exposes women to more risks, like, for instance, you know, sexual harassment, rape, and so on. So this is really a problem. Another problem is migration. So when natural disaster happens, very often men migrate, because since climate change is affected, this generates resource shortages and affecting, you know, the market. So men migrate in order to find a better, you know, economic situation, and they leave women at home with the children. And this is because, of course, traditional beliefs that women cannot to go somewhere else on their own and find a job on their own. And so they stay at home, and because they have to take care of the children, they have to take care of the household, they have also to find some kind of job in order to have the household needs covered. All the time that they spend on these responsibilities do not allow them to spend time on other activities that can help them to increase their knowledge, to contribute in a different way to their communities. Another aspect that we also found was very important is that women are very often in charge of agricultural activities, and so natural disasters and climate change affect food security, because climate change can reduce crop yields and food production. And so it affects food security for women, but also their livelihood strategies. And therefore, the right to food of these people is affected as well. Another aspect is that, as I mentioned earlier, women are primary caregivers, so they take care of the children, of the elderly, and this is also true for developed countries. And so, because of their domestic activities, combined with income-earning activities, again, the burden on women regarding these household activities is really very important, and so it's very hard for them to, for instance, have other job opportunities in order to improve their lives, and also to, again, you know, educate themselves and so on and so forth. So these are very, very important topics that we have been dealing with, and the last one that has been very well, I think, described, particularly during the tsunami, is that women, since they are not allowed to participate in the public sphere, and this is due to cultural, of course, beliefs and practices, very often they are not informed properly when a natural disaster happens, which means that very often these women stayed at home because it was impossible for them to think that they could leave their homes without their husbands. The other problem also was that these women very often are the ones who wait for men, especially when they are the wives of fishermen, and they were waiting for their husbands. And actually, we had more women victims of the floods because they were waiting for their husbands in the seashore. So that was also a problem. So this is more or less the situation that women encounter in different parts of the world. I'm not developing that much regarding the developed world because the situation is a bit different. But as I explained a bit earlier, there are some similarities, particularly because there are also in the developed world domestic tasks that women have to care of. And so this affects their capacity to, you know, to develop themselves and to participate in the decision-making level positions.
That was an excellent introduction.
Thank you.
Yeah. I find it very interesting that most of these problems in climate change and disaster situations arise from already existing power imbalances.
Exactly, yes.
I wonder if we can talk about some of the main strategies for change that you and we do work with, like different ways of empowering women in all these different local situations.
As I said earlier, one of the important topics in order to try to resolve partly at least the problem of coping with climate change and also resolving the problem of energy accessibility is that we need to have women being represented at the decision-making level. And this actually has been supported and claimed by, for instance, Agenda 21 that came from the Earth Summit in 1992. And Agenda 21 is sort of guidelines in order to achieve sustainable development. And they recognize the role of women as principal actors in the management of natural resources. So it's not only a question of how to deal with natural resources, but also to decide on policies in order to have, for instance, environment management. The thing is that women are underrepresented. There are several reasons for that. One of them, of course, is these cultural reasons that enable women to participate, but also because of the nature of the discussions around climate change, and this is very obvious during the UNFCCC, so the UN Framework on Climate Change discussions, this is very highly technical and economic. And unfortunately, for many, many reasons, women do not access technical knowledge, and I mean through university studies and so on. So women do not access to this knowledge, and so it's very hard for them to be involved in these discussions. On the other hand, climate change issues and energy issues should not be only technical discussions. They should also cover the social aspects of that, because ultimately the people who are affected are human beings, both women and men. And so because of the differences I've been exposing earlier, these policies need to take into account the differences, the gender differences between men and women, because all these projects that are supposedly to be implemented through the Kyoto Protocol and through many other mechanisms do not take into account the gender specificities. So if you think about, for instance, poverty reduction, how can you deal with poverty reduction if you don't take into account half of the population in this world, bearing in mind that 70% of the poor are women? So this is really a problem. And we try to address this by through our advocacy work at different UN processes. And so right now what we try to do is to sensitize through these type of documents, not only public opinion, but also political leaders and government representatives, especially at the UN. And there is, of course, a lot of lobby work that is being done and will be done. But the problem is that since this is a pretty new issue in terms of the linkages between climate change and gender, the amount of information that we have in order to make our case is not very easy to find. So one of the things that the women group that has been present at the last conference of the parties of the UNFCCC, one of the things that we did in terms of activities was to organize a workshop on the need to develop research around climate change and gender. So one of the questions, for instance, is what do we need to know about gender and climate change to influence UNFCCC negotiations? Because it's very important also to know that unlike most of the UN international treaties, the UNFCCC doesn't mention gender in any of the treaty and of the Kyoto Protocol. And this is very serious because, as I said, many of the projects that are going to be implemented need to take this into account, and they are not doing it so far. They are concentrating more on the technical and economic aspects of that.
Yeah.
So as I said, one of the ways to do that is to start a research. And another one, of course, is to try as much as possible, because it's also a problem of resources, to develop capacity building among women at the community level, so they become more aware not only of their rights in terms of, you know, human rights, but also to train them in order to for them to be able to participate in decision-making levels, but also on the more technical issues of environmental issues. So this is basically how we are dealing right now with the topic. And in terms of women's participation in the past on climate change issues, as I said, this is a pretty new topic. It happened in previous conferences of the UNFCCC, but it's very, very hard because the UNFCCC doesn't recognize the women's groups as one of the groups that they recognize, like environment, NGOs, indigenous peoples, and so on. So the space that we have is really very, very reduced. It's very new. Women are not totally very well organized on these issues, but we are trying actually to do that.
That's excellent. What do you envision if there were a climate policy shaped with this analysis?
Oh, wow, that's a very difficult
question. That's a big
question.
One, I know.
That's really a very difficult question. Well, in any case, I think that it's really important to consider in the different mechanisms that are starting to be implemented now to really take into account the gender differences, because it's very hard to implement a project without taking into account half of the people, you know, of our community. This should be done through not only recognizing, but also involving women in the decision-making levels, involving them in the way to shape different policies and decisions around mitigation and adaptation policies, so that the needs of everybody are taken into account. And also, I think that another problem is our economic models right now that focus much more on gain, especially for investors. We have a very particular economic model that I believe destroys also certain social aspects of the way we humans live, do not recognize the situation of women, and so on and so forth. So I think these are the issues that need to be tackled and should be considered in the way we should deal with climate change policies.
Where do you have the greatest hope in change coming from, like, given that our economic system is quite inherently flawed, and there's these certain top-down levels of change, like the United Nations? Where do you see the most important change coming from, like, realistically in the coming years? Do you think that the most important change realistically can come from the UN, or come from localized governments, or come from women organizing on the grassroots level, or what do you think needs to happen?
Wow, that's also a hard question. Well, questioning, as I said, this economic model should be a starting point, but of course it has lots of implications that we cannot even imagine. You know, one reason to think like that is, for instance, this Kyoto Protocol is really shaped within this economic model. Instead of putting it into question, we are following it, and this might have consequences that are not necessarily the ones that we would like to see. Like, of course, communities mobilize themselves. The capacity to do that is very difficult, and it varies from country to country, from region to region, because of the political situations of each of those countries. So mobilizing, yes, it happens in some areas, it doesn't happen that much in others, and for instance, civil society is not that well organized in Africa, it's much more better organized in Latin America, but at the same time we know that although things are changing apparently in Latin America, the situation is not easy at all, and you have this economic pressure of private sector through the multinationals' pressure on these governments, so that some decisions that are more favorable to the promotion of human rights, of environmental sustainability, are not being taken into account because of these pressures. So this needs to change, but of course the changes are not coming right now. As we can see, multinationals are having much more and more weight in the decisions that are taken at the international level, illustrated by development of international and regional trade agreements, and we know that most of them, if not all of them, put the investors' rights first and human rights secondary in priority. This shouldn't happen, but it's happened right now, and I don't see exactly how this can change. I don't know, I think it's a very hard question, and I don't see right now real changes coming in for this world.
It's a tough situation.
Yes, I think, and we know it because of, well, coming back to the climate change and natural disasters, even in the U.S., New Orleans was disastrous. And, of course, there were lots of debates on this race issue and lots of economic problems there. There is a lot of migration to other states, as far as I could understand. Even if the U.S. is one of the most developed countries in the world, it seems that they are not really coping very well with this problem. So this, I think, is an illustration that the situation is not very easy right now. And I think it's the same in many, many parts of the world.
Yeah, what I think is one of the most tragic things is that those who are the most marginalized and least privileged are the first and worst to be affected mm-hmm. by these kind of changes. And we see that in New Orleans, and we see that all over the world.
Exactly, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and what I wanted to stress is that among these marginalized, women are even more marginalized for all these gender-based reasons that I exposed earlier.
Mm-hmm. We have about 5 minutes left, Kayetana, and I'm wondering if you'd like to conclude things, wrap things up a little bit.
Yes, actually, I would like to, because the work of WeDo is also at the level of human rights, and I think it's important to conclude to highlight that these natural disasters due to climate change, the lack of appropriate policies in the world regarding climate change, these affect human rights, particularly women's rights. And this was that was reported by the Gender Disaster Workshop in Ankara that took place in 2001. They say that, for instance, economic and social rights are violated in disaster processes if mitigation, relief, and reconstruction policies do not benefit women and men equally. And this is, for instance, what I tried to illustrate by saying that the projects of the clean development mechanisms of the Kyoto Protocol, if they don't take into account the gender aspects, probably they're going to fail. The right of adequate health care is also violated. Also, the right to security of persons is violated when disasters happen and, for instance, women are raped or they are subject to violence by men. And civil and political rights are denied to women if they cannot fully participate into the decision-making level processes that will affect them in one way or the other. So I just want to conclude that this is really a human rights issue, and this is, of course, it affects men. I think that women and men have to work together, but we have to take into account the differences and to involve both of them equally. And just to perhaps end in a positive note, there is an example in Honduras. There is a region called La Masica who reported no deaths after Hurricane Mitch in 1998. And one of the reasons for this is that men and women were equally involved in the preparation for disasters, also on early warning systems and hazard management. And so when Hurricane Mitch hit that particular region, the way that people, you know, managed to organize themselves in order not to be affected by that took into account both women and men needs, women and men realities. For, I mean, this is an illustration that when you involve men and women equally, there is a high chance that the consequences of these natural disasters are going to be as bad.
In a little while we just might see the end is near, but it will be too close to recognize. While we keep looking for that light to reappear, it will be lost inside the shadow of our eyes. We'll be lost inside the lies.
Thanks to Healing the Earth Radio for that interview on women and climate change. We have a poem for you now by Trudy Anderson of Kittery, Maine. It's entitled Sadness. How can it be that a woman like me, who has been given the name Joy in so many cultures, on so many continents, in so many languages, feel such sorrow? Each day I bathe, I wash clothes, I drink clean water. Yet I know you, my precious sister, can do none of these. My tears could fill a profound cup for you to drink today. That was Sadness by Trudy Anderson of Kittery, Maine. And now for Sarah McLachlan with World on Fire.
Mm-hmm.
straight line on this short run. The more we take, the less we become. The fortune of one man means less for some.
That was World on Fire by Sarah McLachlan. You're listening to Making Waves. Now for another Healing the Earth interview. This one is with Linda Bazell Saltzman, an eco-psychologist, psychotherapist, and permaculturist, talking about ways of healing the human nature split.
Hello, this is Healing the Earth Radio, and today I'm interviewing Linda Bazell Saltzman, who is an eco-psychologist and eco-therapist, and is the founder of the International Association for Eco-Therapy. She's been a psychotherapist in private practice for over 25 years, and she's also a fellow at For the Future, a think tank that deals with sustainability and recovery from consumerism. She is the originator of For the Future Sustainable Small Cities Project, and she teaches classes at Santa Barbara City College on eco-psychology, eco-therapy, and career opportunities in an emerging sustainable society. She and her husband Larry are the founders of the Santa Barbara Organic Garden Club, and they've created an edible backyard food forest on their city lot, growing vegetables, herbs, tasty flowers, and over 60 fruit and nut trees. So Linda, do you think you can please tell us, in your perspective, what eco-psychology and eco-therapy is, and what kind of work you're doing right now?
Well, I've been a therapist for about 30 years, and it's only within about the last 10 years that I've really kind of moved in the direction of green psychotherapy, which is just another word for eco-psychotherapy or eco-therapy. And for me, what happened was that I began to get closer to the earth myself. We moved into a suburban area where I was able to work with my husband, and we have built kind of an urban food forest in our yard instead of the usual suburban forest. And we got involved in permaculture, and just doing all of this and gardening and growing our own food and all of that began to change me. And it began, of course, then to change my practice, because I realized that unless we include our relationship with nature in our diagnosis of anyone or trying to figure out what is making people hurt, none of it makes any sense. And once you do include your relationship with the earth as well as human-human relationships, a lot of things make more sense than they did before. At least that's been my experience.
Mm-hmm. I like how you talked about gardening to begin, because I find gardening such a transformative thing.
It really is, and it's only one of many ecotherapies, but I think it's one of the most powerful.
Mm-hmm. And where do you see this human nature split having arisen from, and what do you feel are the main forces today working to propagate it?
Oh, boy. I mean, it certainly has a long history, especially mm-hmm. in Western culture, that we've been sort of, you know, moving up into the sky somewhere and not really realizing that we're part of the earth. And I think that the problem has accelerated, let's say, in the last 50 to 75 years, as we've become more and more industrialized and more corporate, more and more global. All of those factors really remove us from daily connection with the earth, and we literally forget that we're
completely part of the Earth and dependent on the Earth for our day-to-day survival. And one of the ways that this has become most clear to me is in beginning to grow my own food. Because before that, I really was just like everybody else, thinking that food just somehow comes in packages at the supermarket. And it never occurred to me that it actually grew in the ground somewhere or was an animal. And where did it come from and how did it get shipped here and how much fossil fuel was involved in making it and shipping it. And I just didn't think about any of that. And somehow growing my own food and eating my own food kind of woke me up to the fact that we are part of the Earth. We eat the Earth every day. And, of course, the Earth eats us and will eat us.
Mm-hmm. I was at a recent talk by a woman talking about biodynamic farming, mm-hmm. and she was talking about how soil is like the soul of the earth,
yeah.
in a sense, and plants in this, you know, intricate, complex, you know, energetic relationship with the earth are kind of also like the soul of the earth, and by eating locally, we're in a sense communing with the spirit of the earth that we live on.
It's true. It really does connect you, and even things like going to the farmer's market, meeting the farmers who grow some of your food. There's a real soul-satisfyingness to a whole natural way of living. And one of my things that I like to work on with clients is what I call lifestyle therapy, which is one of the many ecotherapies. And that really has to do with asking yourself, you know, how am I living every day? And am I living in a way that's natural for me as a person and as a human animal? Or am I living in a completely unnatural way? You know, time stressed, rushing around, all of the things that we all do. And is that affecting my physical and mental health? Because once you begin to ask those questions, you start to realize that a lot of what we call, you know, mental health problems are actually people being driven mad by the way we're living.
Mm-hmm. Understandably so.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I'd like to talk a bit about mental illness in our industrial society. Because I find it fascinating that using the definitions of various mental illnesses, as described by the American Psychology Association, civilized humans in their relationship to nature fit the criteria of all kinds of forms of psychosis. And I just wonder if you can talk about what it mean, or what does it mean when our various standards of mental illness mean that we're all insane in a sense, and like, what do you try to do with your work to heal this?
Well, I think one of the first ways to heal is to understand that it's not necessarily you.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that you're in a situation that it doesn't fit who the human animal is and what we've evolved to be. So to not blame yourself. I mean, if we think about animals in zoos, for instance, you know, it's only recently that we figured out that if you put a tiger in a cage that's too small, but he will start to behave really strangely after a while. And, in fact, we had a situation like that here where I live in Santa Barbara with our zoo. Our zoo adopted an elderly gorilla named Max. And poor Max had been brought up on concrete in some very too small zoo. So, you know, our zoo rescued him, which was wonderful. And they put him in this lovely situation where he had lots of grass, he had running water, he had two friends they introduced into the cage. What was interesting was that Max really never recovered. Max would sit in his little corner of this new enclosure on a little tiny bit of concrete that was there, and he would sort of shake. I mean, I see us as human beings. Many of us are in exactly that situation, that we've been forced for years to live in completely unnatural ways. And is it surprising that we have various symptoms?
Mm-hmm. I think it's entirely understandable. And there's so many different ways where that comes into play, like how this way of life is unnatural, even being surrounded by straight lines and 90-degree angles and mm-hmm. living in rooms that are boxes is really
right.
weird for our consciousness as well.
I always like to remember that we evolved during the Pleistocene and to kind of imagine in my mind what those early bands of humans were like and where they lived and what their environment was and how they were. And it's kind of a touchstone for me. And because there's a deep, deep physical, psychological, and spiritual connection with that way of living, whenever we're in small groups and we're in in extended family situations and multi-generational and very close to nature. I mean, we feel so good. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because somewhere our bodies remember that that's who we are.
Mm-hmm. Because I guess industrial, or I guess even civilization itself, has really only been but a blip on our evolutionary scale, I guess.
It is. And it's not that we're going to throw out the baby with the bathwater. I mean, there's good aspects of this as well. But mm-hmm. I think that we can create a new way of being that includes the best of the old and the best of the new. And that's certainly what I know permaculture is about, and we've gotten involved in the whole permaculture thing in our building of our backyard food forest. And, for instance, one of the things we discovered was it was highly satisfying to go out into our food forest, which has 60 fruit trees on a third of an acre, so it's very crowded and foresty, and we would graze for food. And it's like it was kind of a little surprising to both of us how satisfying that felt. Just get up in the morning and wander out and just kind of, you know, graze around, see what's out there, pick a berry here, you know, taste a rose hip over there, just graze through it. Pick up an onion. And it sounds very mundane, but on some deeper level, it's really powerful and it's really healing.
I'd like to hear more about your backyard food forest. If you don't mind sharing with us, like, the process of creating it and what kind of things you've learned or insights into, like, your own life in a city through creating that.
Well, when we bought the house, it's a little, what we wanted was a little house on a bit of land, you know, more land than house, in other words, which is the exact opposite, of course, of the all-American dream. People here are building these huge McMansions covering every bit of land you can and then having little sort of artificial shrubs around the rest. So we wanted to do the opposite, and the land was really dry and not fertile at all. And gradually we just kept planting and planting and planting, and luckily we did run into these permaculture people when we moved in, and they came and looked and they said, "Oh, you're building a permaculture food forest." And we said, "What's that?" And so they helped guide us as we continued to do this. And what it really involves is building an ecosystem so that you have your overstory trees, your understory trees, your shrubs. Our next thing we want to put in is coffee and tea, which luckily grow in our area, which are classic sort of understory plants. And the more the plants grew and the more we ate our own food, it really began to transform us. You know, in the beginning, you think you're making the garden, but what happens is the garden starts to make you.
I like that. And I was wondering if you can talk a bit more about your ecotherapy practice or the work you do. And different, like you mentioned a little bit, that gardening is one of the best ecotherapies. Can you talk a bit more about that and other forms you try to get people to do?
Well, another form of ecotherapy is animal-assisted therapy. And that one I kind of stumbled over. You know, we had a dog when I was just beginning my practice. And I was practicing at home. I had a little home office. And it was really interesting to me to watch when people came to the door that, of course, Pookie, who was a small sort of lovable dog, would run up to them and demand attention and wanted to be welcomed and would welcome them. And people would show up at the door either crying or depressed or just listless or whatever their, you know, their state was when they were coming into therapy. And it was amazing that just minutes of contact with this animal, let alone with me, would immediately relax them and put a smile on their face, and they would sit in their chair in my counseling room and pet the dog, and their whole body would just start healing. And then they were able to really share what was going on a deeper level and to really be heard and really listen. And so I always used to joke that dog, Pookie, was my co-therapist. And, of course, now we've got all kinds of research to show that this really does work. It wasn't just, you know, some kind of accident. that when we're in contact, especially physical contact with animals, that our blood pressure changes and certainly our psychology changes.
I wonder if that would work the same with humans as well. But I guess the thing with dogs is that they're much more, there's not as much social awkwardness if someone would walk in.
Exactly, right, right. I don't think if I climbed into my client's laps that it would have quite the same effect. Might be a little startling.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, yeah, it's just, animals are just, first of all, they're natural for us, aren't they? Again, coming back to that idea of living naturally. You know, that when you think, again, of those early bands of people, you realize that they weren't alone. I mean, they had, very early, they had their dogs, they had other animals. It's just part of how we are and how we're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And when we artificially separate ourselves out in, you know, little cubicles, it's just not the way we're meant to exist.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear some thoughts of yours on how successful you or other people you've seen have been in trying to use that as a reason to increase biodiversity in urban areas, like the need on deeper levels for wilderness and for wild animals and for all kinds of animals to be around us. Because that's what I see as one of the biggest problems with, like in the city I live in, is familiar to you as well, probably, that, you know, most any green space left is usually bought up by a developer as soon as they can, and then there's one less home for wild animals.
Oh, yes. I mean, we're suffering from that here, like everywhere. We've got big fights going on locally, as you probably do, too, to mm-hmm. save the last green space, and it's really an important thing to do. But one thing I learned is that wilderness is not the only place that you can connect with nature. And, in fact, most of us get into wilderness so rarely that we really have to focus on nearby nature, which includes even a little tiny patch in front of your apartment building. I mean, it doesn't matter what it is. A local park would be great. Anything you can do to connect with that will certainly be healing for you. And then, of course, the idea is that we have to be reciprocal with nature. It's not enough for us to be using nature to heal ourselves. We obviously have to be reciprocating that with doing everything we can to protect the rest of nature.
This is Making Waves. We're listening to a Healing the Earth interview with Linda Bazell Saltzman, eco-psychologist, psychotherapist, and permaculturist, talking about healing the human-nature split. We're breaking now for announcements, after which we will return to this interview.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.